Good morning. It's good to be with you again. I don't know if your children here do what mine do, but an important part of childhood for them seems to be dressing up. So my daughters especially, from a very early age, fell in love with the Little House on the Prairie series, so they like to come around dressed in hoop skirts and various things tied on their heads, bonnets or whatever. Carrying other things in their hands, and of course their feet always were clad in some outlandish footwear. One of the favorite things they would do is come up to me all dressed up and say, "Daddy, who am I?" Now, they still do some of this, but it was far more interesting earlier because you never knew. I mean, they could be dressed up as an obvious female and sometimes say, "I'm Almanzo," or "I'm Paul," or something like that. It was really, you never knew what they were going to say they were. However, after a couple of guesses, and I was stymied every time, I learned to say, "Yeah, I know who you are. You're Xenia, or you're Kirza, or you're Daryl's children." And they didn't like that because I was seeing through their disguise. They knew I could, but I think the Muslim world kind of feels the same way with the Western nations of Europe and the United States having gone through a kind of profound change in how governing works, and with this new guise of secularism, of not connecting religion with the state, it seems to them like the old enemy is coming back to them saying, "Who am I? We're somebody new." And they say, "No, you're still who you have always been." So I think we should look at the radical changes that occur in the pivotal years surrounding the world wars, World War I and II, so that we can understand maybe the current thinking between Muslims and Christians, or maybe the a more modern reason for some of the tension. So in historical thinking, if you're trying to explain an event or a position, you always look at the nearest reason for it and then follow the threads back into history. And the more proximate the event is to what you're trying to explain, the more of an effect it has. So if we look at the Crusades, or if we look at, you know, the starting of Islam, that tells us where, how the cycles have begun. But if we want to look at why the feelings, the tensions are high right now, there are often closer examples of problems. Now, the world wars aren't the closest example. I just had to stop somewhere. And it is certainly the biggest modern reason for the tension right now, because it sets up what we know of as the modern Middle East. It draws a lot of the lines on the ground. So my job today, this morning, is to try to help you understand that. And then in our second session, we're going to try to wrap it up. In the second session, there won't be much history. We'll be referring to the history, but we're going to be trying to pull together the history we have learned and try to make some informed decisions from that. So, in order to understand what's going on in the Middle East during the world wars, we're going to have to kind of remember or be exposed to what has happened in the Ottoman Empire. So, the last time we encountered the Ottoman Empire last night, they were at the height of their power. They had just conquered Constantinople. They went on for a century and a half after that to kind of terrorize Europe and to sort of be the big, scary Muslim presence on Europe's borders. Those days are long past. Shifting trade routes, Europe undergoing an industrial revolution. There are other causes you could look at, but all of these things have happened. Also, Europe discovered two new continents in the Western Hemisphere and has been shifting a lot of its attention that direction. And the Ottoman Empire has seen its revenues decline. It's gone from a wealthy, powerful state to a fairly weak state. So it got so weak during the 1850s that Britain was actually trying to prop it up because Britain was worried that Russia was going to take all of the Ottoman Empire. Britain didn't want that happening, so Britain's been trying to prop up the empire, and it's been fighting on its side some every now and then when it suited it to keep the Russians from taking over. So we're going to now take a quick look at a world map showing how the world has changed. Now, this map is, I think, drawn to be understood right at the end of World War I. And we're going to be talking about it before World War I, so it's not quite accurate. And the place where it suffers the most is here in the Ottoman Empire. You'll see the Ottoman Empire is given a striped red look. Okay, I said I wasn't going to do colors. It's given this look right here. And that's not quite accurate. Before World War I, the Ottoman Empire was under its own control. But the rest of the world, everywhere you see that color, those are areas of the world directly controlled by European powers. This yellow color, there I go again. The yellow color is a European descendants are ruling there. So this is, of course, places like the United States, most of South America. So the world has become Europeanized in a way that was really hard to imagine back in the 1450s, where we last left it. The rapid industrialization of Europe has also occurred. So Europe has gone through this process of kind of turning out huge factories that manufacture goods at unbelievable pace, and also a massive growth in shipping size and power. Transportation has become just mind-bogglingly efficient. And communication has gotten far more rapid. By this time, they have telegraph cables laid under the world's or across several of the world's oceans. You can communicate between continents in very, very short time periods. It feels like the world has changed really rapidly. So we talk about this period as the long European century. And it starts with the French Revolution of 1789. That's roughly when the French Revolution starts. And it goes until the catastrophe of World War I in 1914. So that's more than a century, but it's the century when European powers really reached their zenith. And in that time frame, there were some wars in Europe, but in general, Europe's its culture and its political power and its military power have just been on a steady climb. In that time frame, several new ideologies have come along. With the industrialization of the continent, or maybe you might say of the world, has come problems, and those problems have seemed to be insurmountable. And various ideologies have come along to help with those. So this is the time frame when you're starting to see groups of people wanting more socially responsible governments. So you can talk about socialism coming along here. Communism as a wing of socialism also comes along during this time frame. And on the other side of the political spectrum, another ideology is coming along called nationalism. And nationalism is this idea that the nation, as defined by a people's language and shared culture, the nation should be one thing separate from everybody else, and it's the kind of the ultimate thing. It's sort of the best thing, and you should be willing to sacrifice everything for the nation. So that idea is growing alongside of these other ideas. So communism is seen more as an international movement, wanting to connect across national borders. Socialism is often more that way. And nationalism is wanting to harden the borders and to kind of circle the wagons and make your nation a special place where only your people live. Both of these ideologies are going to grow, and they're going to clash frequently. It is going to be primarily nationalism that is responsible for World War I and to some extent II as well. So as this ideology grew, alongside of it grew another ideology, another manifestation of its ideology, and that is, well, if Germans and Italians can have their own nation state, then what about all the other people groups? Should they not as well? Now, you might not understand how unusual this idea is. Until this time, and during the war period, we're going to see this more starkly, but until this time, emperors and empires grew by adding different groups of people to their political structure. So you might have, and you did in World War I, you might have an empire composed of two nations, like Austria and Hungary. It's one empire called the Empire of Austria-Hungary. Austro-Hungarian Empire is another way you can say it. And so this concept of an empire composed of disparate people groups all under one thing, that's coming into conflict with current thinking. It's coming into conflict with nationalism. And so these other groups say, we want to break away from the empires and make our own separate little nations. Well, there were nationalistic movements like that. Some of them produced new nations. So the Germans managed to unite and make a modern Germany during this long century. The Italians united and made it a modern Italy during this century. Those are two brand new nations, and they're going to be both embroiled in World War I. There were groups of people who wanted to do that for other people, groups as well. So the Slavs, especially the Slavs kind of in the Balkan Peninsula right in here, they also wanted their own nation, and there were various iterations of that nationalism. None of them quite produced a nation. The Turks, interestingly enough, in the Ottoman Empire, the Turks wanted to make a nation state as well. So how do you draw a border for a Turkish nationality? It's been here for a long time. Do we make it go all the way out into here? Is that what's going to be Turkey? Well, I mean, that's they all speak a Turkic style language, so that's, of course, something that is considered. Arabs are wanting to make a nation state. Now, the Ottoman Empire is still going on, but you have these different factions in the Ottoman Empire that start talking about how can we make a nation for ourselves. So these nationalistic movements grow in various ethnic groups, ethnic and cultural groups. The Serbs are successful eventually in creating Serbia, but it's a little bit after this time. I'm not going to be able to give you a very detailed account of World War I and its causes, but I want to at least note the nationalism because it's really important to the war and it's important to understanding what's going to happen in the Muslim world after the war. The Jews have a nationalistic movement. They have several, and various ideas are floated as to where to build a nation for Jews. So, for a time, some thought, well, we can go way out here in Siberia and Manchuria and maybe make a Jewish nation over there. Interestingly for you guys, in Texas was another place where they had thought of making a nation state for Jews. They had found some land in Texas. We buy up a bunch of this land. It's cheap. And we can move a bunch of Jews from around the world here. But of course, the Jewish Zionists had a better answer, they thought. And that is, let us go to Palestine, our ancient homeland, and let's build a Jewish state there. So, different ideas for the Jewish nationalists about where to build a state. But the reason it was an issue is because they were a group of people who had a distinct culture and a distinct language and a distinct religion, but they were scattered throughout a bunch of the nations of Europe. They really didn't exist in any one place in great enough numbers to claim a certain section of land. So Jewish national movements are afoot as well. So all of these people groups are wanting a nation, and they're living in something other than the nation they want to live in. That's all going on during this long 18th century. 19th century. On the eve of World War I, the big empires are starting to look a little creaky, a little old-fashioned, a little bit insecure, because they had all these restive populations inside of them. Who knows what's going to happen when war breaks out? Are they going to all get together and fight for this empire or not? And the new shiny nation states like Germany and to some degree France. France isn't new, but it has kind of become, since the Revolution, something a little bit different from what it had been before. And Italy is another one. Those are looking kind of like the new cutting-edge way to rule people and to govern people. And then World War I hits. And World War I was a civilizationally catastrophic event. It, in many ways, ended Europe's civilization, at least what had been. And what came out of it was something different than what had existed before. So I can't really tell you all of the pieces and the story of how the war starts. But if you take a look at this rather strange-looking map of Europe, you'll see some of the big personalities going on. So you've got Russia over here. Russia is looking pretty large and robust. That is a fiction. Russia is a tottering empire. The Tsar has been ruling over groups of people that have wanted to completely change the system for a long time, and especially groups that have been talking about socially appropriate government, government that cares about people. Those groups have been making inroads there. So communism, of course, is one of them, and that's, of course, going to become a big thing. We can't probably tell that story very well. Down here, you've got the Turkish Ottoman Empire. He's looking pretty sad. I mean, he's weak. By this time, the diplomats are talking about the Ottoman Empire as the sick old man of Europe. You can't see it very well, but there is an independent Greece down there. Of course, over here in Britain, John Bull is looking pretty healthy. He's angling in troubled waters. You've got kind of a knot of individuals here in France that kind of suggests some of the troubled nature of the Republic at that time. So then here in the center, you've got Germany. Germany under Kaiser Wilhelm II is, well, it's charming, and it's organized, and it's militaristic, and it's dangerous. Very dangerous. Germany probably has the most formidable army in Europe. But of course, it's caught in the middle. It's got France on one side and Russia on the other side, so it has a very poor strategic location. I would love to give you a blow-by-blow account of the war, but I can't. So we're going to kind of zoom ahead now. Just note that Germany and Austro-Hungary and the Ottoman Empire all ally during this war, and that's why they're called the Central Powers. And they're fighting against the powers on either side. So the Russians are the only major kind of old-fashioned style empire on the side of the Allies. Britain is an empire, but its empire is built more on colonialism, so it's more overseas and not so much other European nations in its empire. So its problems of empire are pushed farther away than the others are. So in many ways, it doesn't deal with, except for Ireland over here, it doesn't deal with the problems of empire in this war like the others do. So the central powers here are Germany, Austria-Hungary, and the Ottoman Empire. And it includes two of those old empires. So the war is going to completely change the way people are governed, because by and large, with the possible exception of the British Empire, almost all of the empires go away during this war and are replaced by something more like a nation state. So the war happens. We're going to fast forward through it. And the Ottoman Empire loses alongside of all the others. Well, this is it's a catastrophe for the Ottoman Empire, but it's also the end for the Ottoman Empire. This brings the Ottoman Empire to its knees. It's over. It surrenders. And it looks like the empire is simply going to break apart into its pieces. So this map can help you see the different ethnic groups that have been a part of this empire. So you'll see the black are the Turks. You'll see sprinkles of red along these edges. Those are Greeks, and of course there are some up here as well. The yellow are the Armenians, and at the beginning of the war, the Armenian genocide had occurred, is where the Turkish government did their best to get the Armenians out of their borders and kill them because they saw the Armenians as Christians like the Russians, and the Russians are coming down to attack them. And so they're worried that the Armenians are going to be a fifth column and join those other Christians, the Russians. And so the genocide happened, and that's why this area is depopulated of Armenians. The Armenians largely, bunches of them are killed. It's a terrible time. And the rest that survive kind of move up into this area over here. This map is getting a little messy, so let's clean it up. The Kurds, this blue section are the Kurds, and they form a very large but pretty stable population. The Ottoman government isn't too worried about the Kurds because they're Sunni Muslim. And the Kurds, even though they're a distinct ethnic group, they have been loyal subjects of the empire for a long time. Now, the Arabs are a slightly different thing. Of course, the Arabs are very Muslim as well. But the Arabs used to, back in the days of Muhammad and Ali, they used to be, you know, the imperial power. They were the one conquering other people. So now they have been ruled since the Abbasid Caliphate kind of surrendered to the Seljuk Turks. They have been ruled by this Turkish group, these various Turkish groups coming out of the steppes. And they sort of see the Turks as kind of a little bit, they're not pure Arabians, you know? And so the Arabs kind of have this difference of opinion with the Turks. So the Ottoman Empire is sitting on this kind of multilingual, multicultural group of people. So what do you do when the empire loses? How do you deal with that? So what happened in the Treaty of Sevres is the Ottoman Empire was divvied up amongst the two most powerful nations in the winning coalition. So France and Britain both got sections of the Ottoman Empire to govern. You'll see the British influence is in the red areas, the French influence is in the blue areas. Part of those are directly ruled by those countries, and others are just under kind of nominal control. But note that with the Ottoman Empire going away, there is no big nation in the area that is Muslim. There is an independent Egypt, and after Ataturk is done with Turkey, there is an independent Turkey. That kind of develops with time. But the Persian Shah is largely under British control because of various agreements and kind of dependence on British ammunition and guns. The Shah really needs the British. So the people that have the most power in this section are the French and the British. In other words, the Christians. So the entire Muslim Middle East is suddenly feeling that there's this new master in town that's controlling them. So maybe let's tell a little bit of the story, I'll do it very briefly, of the founding of the Turkish Republic out of the ashes of the Ottoman Empire. So this is the borders that are eventually formed. But under the first treaty in the aftermath of World War I, this is not how the borders looked. Rather, the Greeks had been given a very significant section right in here around the port city of Izmir. So the Greeks moved their army over there, and they weren't satisfied with that. They just kept moving their army. Now, you don't do that to a nation of people who have been used to winning wars for a long time. And the only successful military commander to come out of World War I on the Turkish side was a man by the name of Kemal Mustafa. Or else Mustafa Kemal. I can't remember ever which way it goes. I think it's Mustafa Kemal. I get those confused in my head sometimes. He's a very famous general. He successfully fends off the British invasion of Gallipoli, and he is seen as the best general. So when the Greeks are moving up into central Anatolia, he travels from Constantinople to the port city of Samsun, rallies his old men in uniform around him, and starts recreating an army. The Ottoman Empire hasn't really been governed for a year or two. There's been a lot of chaos. And Ataturk says, I now know the answer to that nationalism question. We need to be a nation, and the nation is Turkey for the Turks. And it doesn't go out on the steppes. It's just this section right here. That's what we want. You need to give us that. Get rid of these Greeks that are over there in Izmir. Give us Anatolia, and that'll be our nation. So this really energizes the Turkish military. They band behind him. He's a very skillful general. And very quickly, he manages to push the Greeks back down into the port of Izmir. And then, to the horror of everybody watching, he starts the city on fire and just pushes the Greeks out into the harbor. Now, there are British and French ships in the harbor, but nobody wants to get started in World War II. I mean, this is just after World War I. It's in the 1920s. Nobody wants another war going on. And the British and the French militaries are officially neutral. And so the Greeks are trying frantically to get away. Some of them are getting in rowboats and rowing out to the ships. Other guys are being basically chased into the water. They're almost drowning, grabbing a hold of ships, trying to pull them, or little boats trying to pull themselves in. Guys on the boats are worried they're going to be capsized. They're taking hatchets and cutting off fingers so that they can keep going. It's just a terrible, terrible experience. And Ataturk wins this war and pushes the Greeks out of Anatolia. He basically forces the Allies to come back to the negotiating table, and the borders of modern Turkey are established at the Treaty of Lausanne. So Turkey, as we know it now, what we call the Republic of Turkey, is born out of this ashes of the Ottoman Empire. But the rest of the Ottoman Empire in the Middle East is going to be ruled by the mandate countries of France and Britain. They're going to be the ones who kind of say what happens there. Now, the Allies, they sort of just drew lines on a map. In fact, we get kind of... It was a little bit more thoughtful than that, but not much. They didn't have very many people doing the work. They were kind of overworked, and they didn't really care all that much. These were people they didn't know much about. So the borders of the modern Middle East, like Iraq and Jordan, Saudi Arabia, Palestine, we're going to get into that later, Syria, those borders were just kind of drawn by Westerners who knew very little about it. And so people groups like the Kurds, they get split into three different countries. Iraq is this strange mixture of, it's got almost equal numbers of Shia and Sunni Muslims in it, as well as the rest of Kurdish population. So you have all kinds of different nationalities all jammed into a national border by these Western Christians who really didn't know much about what they were doing. They were just we're overworked and underpaid, and we need to get something figured out here, so that's what we're going to do. They did rule the countries for a while. We'll get to the independence part later. But a lot of the chaos going on in the Middle East now has at least some connection to the strange borders drawn during this period of time, because the Ottoman Empire had overseen a fairly peaceful Middle East for most of its time, because it allowed kind of each religious group to sort of rule themselves and report back to the Sultan. And each ethnic group kind of had its own little hierarchy. So it was a very natural way for the groups to interact with each other. And they didn't find it very strange. And then along come the British and the French, and they do this weird drawing lines of saying, now you're a nation sort of thing. And nobody quite knows how this works. So it's confusing. So by the end of this mandate period, Islam is almost entirely ruled by non-Islamic powers. Now, of course, Turkey is an exception there. Many of these powers were nations whose populations identified as Christians, primarily. So the elephant in the room here that we need to talk about is Palestine. Palestine has a uniquely Christian connection that, if we're going to understand how Christians and Islam got to the, how Christianity and Islam gets to the place it is, we've got to talk about Palestine and the state of the modern birth of Israel. I'll try to do this quickly. And do note that I am attempting to give you the consensus position by historians. I am attempting to stay out of the controversies of who's right and who's wrong there. Just show you what's happened so you know where the pain buttons are. So the first thing that we should talk about is this document. This is written in 1917. So it's at the height of World War I. The British Lord Balfour wrote this note to Lord Rothschild, who's the head of a banking family of Jews, who has a long history of banking in the in Europe, and he's also deeply connected to the Zionist Federation. Dear Lord Rothschild, I have much pleasure in conveying to you, on behalf of His Majesty's government, the following declaration of sympathy with the Jewish Zionist aspirations, which has been submitted to and approved by the Cabinet. His Majesty's government view with favor the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people, and will use their best endeavors to facilitate the achievement of this object, it being clearly understood that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of the existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine, or the rights and political status enjoyed by Jews in any other country. I should be grateful if you would bring this declaration to the knowledge of the Zionist Federation. So in the height of World War I, the British government just up and says, hey, Lord Rothschild, we would be happy to have some Jews settle in Palestine and make that a Jewish homeland. We'd want to be careful with the non-Jews there, but you can think fondly that if we win the war, you get to have a Jewish state in Palestine. Well, this would answer nicely the question of the Zionists, right? How do we get a Jewish state established in Zion or in Palestine? Well, we do it because the British will help us. Now, the question you should be asking is, well, how is that a Christian connection? So to get that, we've got to kind of look at what went on before 1917, or maybe understand why. First, though, before we get to that, do note that the British are running out of money. They're deeply in debt to the United States at this point, and they are looking for money. So one of the things that's hoped would happen is that the wealthy Jews would contribute money to the British treasury out of gratitude for this act of magnanimously giving them a chunk of land. So that's partly what the British government is after, is some funding for their war. But let's note what led to this, aside from the money thing. And this quote comes from a document marked secret that was presented to the British cabinet in 1915, so this isn't the first, it's in January of 1915, so it's in the first 4 or 5 months of the war. Very early in the war, when the British were considering invading the Ottoman Empire, a guy by the name of Herbert Samuel wrote this memorandum. It was marked secret, and eventually it has been declassified since then. I'm just reading a tiny excerpt from the thing to give you a sense of the flavor of it. But this is what he is suggesting as a brainstorming session for the cabinet to think about. Widespread and deep-rooted in the Protestant world is a sympathy with the idea of restoring the Hebrew people to the land which was to be their inheritance, and intense interest in the fulfillment of the prophecies which have foretold it. The redemption also, oh, that's a typo, of the Christian holy places from the vulgarization to which they are now subject, and the opening of the Holy Land more easily than hitherto to the visits of Christian travelers, would add to the appeal which this policy would make to the British peoples. So at the highest levels in the British government, one of the things that has formed the policy laid out in the Balfour Declaration to Lord Rothschild of a Jewish national state, one of those things is the Protestant world sympathy for the Jewish national cause. It's stuff like this that make the Muslim nations say, see, we knew you were Christians all along. You guys are here doing what you Christians have always done. So let's talk about what goes on here in Palestine. In the 1930s, Jewish immigration starts. This is a little bit early to go to this slide. You can peruse it, and I'll explain it a little bit more later. But in the 1930s, after the war ends, the Balfour Declaration has been made, so the Jews start immigrating to Palestine and buying up land. Now, these are largely fairly wealthy people often, and they're buying up land from relatively poor native Palestinians, or you might say Arabs and Aramaeans and various other groups that live in the land. And this kind of goes on quietly for a period of time in the 1930s until suddenly the locals start saying, we've got a lot of Europeans living among us. And some gangs begin to be formed. And both sides form gangs, and both of them are kind of fighting in the streets. So there are Jewish gangs of Europeans, and there are Arab gangs of Islamic Muslim believers. And they're fighting in the streets. And it gets quite terrible. By the end of the 1930s, there's some really serious violence going on, even as Jewish immigration continues and the Jewish population of Palestine keeps growing. This violence gets worse. Eventually, the British managed to bring peace to the situation by kind of flooding the streets with soldiers and working out some peace deals with the various factions. But it's an uneasy situation. And then World War II happens. And World War II when we think of World War II, we have to think of the Holocaust. The Holocaust is this terrible moment for Jews in Europe. And a big part of the reason why during the 1930s Jews were moving to Palestine was increasingly Nazi Germany had been getting harder and harder to live in, and people were wanting out, and there weren't very many countries that were accepting Jewish immigrants. And so Palestine is one place they could go. The Holocaust comes, and it completely devastates European Jewry. Whatever is left after the Holocaust are the bits and the pieces. Entire families are destroyed, maybe one or two survivors from some families, none from others. The religious and cultural life of the Jews has been completely upended. It is an awful experience. The world that comes out of World War I is a world that is deeply sympathetic to Jews, especially America and England and France. They all say, this terrible Holocaust should never have happened. Is there anything we can do to help them? Well, the British have this place called Palestine, and what if we just let them become a nation down there like the British have planned? Wouldn't that help? And so that is kind of what happens. In 1947, the United Nations passes a resolution to partition the land of Palestine between the Palestinians and the Jews. And so there can be a Jewish state. So what you see on this side, in 1947, this color is what the UN has offered to the Jews as their state. They say all the lands, I guess it's orange. All the orange lands are Jewish lands, and the yellow will belong to the Arabs. And you guys can have your separate states, and this will be a homeland for these Holocaust survivors. That was greeted with just ecstatic joy by the Jewish communities in Palestine. The Arabs were devastated. And almost immediately a war breaks out between the Jewish factions and the Arab factions. Even though the British are still there, independence isn't going to be granted until May of 1948. So there's still a bit of time here, the rest of 47 and parts of the early part of 48. And the British are still in the peacekeeping role. And you've got Arab militias and Jewish militias out in the streets fighting with each other. They're trying to get convoys from one city to the next, and the other groups are attacking those convoys. This is where the Jewish Haganah and the Irgun both have their start. Both of these are going to eventually get rolled into the IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces of the State of Israel. But this is a very serious battle going on between people who live in Palestine. It's pretty much the borders of Palestine. It's an internal conflict. And the Jewish Haganah and Irgun and other militias managed to win that largely. They were able eventually to kind of outfight their rival gangs. And the British kind of just let them fight it out because they don't have enough guys there. And the wars, I mean, big war just happened. Nobody wants another war. When May of 1948 rolls around, the only thing the British have done particularly well in this earlier period is they have been keeping Jewish immigration in check, because they had come up with some policies that Jews weren't allowed to move to Palestine just yet. They had those previously were set up back before World War I, and they kind of kept those policies in place. And so the Jews that were Holocaust survivors were often trying to get to Israel, and they were stopped by the British Navy. And so oftentimes these Jewish refugees, they'd just gone through the worst experience they can imagine, anybody can imagine. They're free. They're out of the concentration camps. They make their way through southern Europe. They get on a boat and try to get to Israel, and the British Navy stops them, turns them around, and makes them go land on Cyprus. And in Cyprus, they're put in a refugee camp that looks kind of like some of the earlier camps they've been in. It is a bad time. And these people feel kicked around. And they have collectively the sense that injustice has been occurring. Well, as soon as Israel is given its independence, May 1948, I think it's May 14, I can't remember, the official handover of responsibility to the state of Israel to govern itself is given. And instantly, Jordan, Egypt, and Syria all attack. They are determined to push out the Jews so that they don't establish this Jewish state there, because they want an Arab-Palestinian state. Well, the attacks of these countries really galvanized the Jewish forces. And the Jews had already more or less gotten control of the territory they were in. So now they're defending interior lines against these attacking Arab forces. And the Arab forces don't agree with each other. They're all out for their own thing. Jordan wants the old city of Jerusalem, and it doesn't really want Egypt to get too big of a slice. Syria wants to make sure it gets the Golan Heights, and it wants to keep as much of northern Israel as it can. It doesn't want Jordan to be too successful. So there are other factions I'm not mentioning, but these various Arab states don't want the others to succeed super well. So they're not working well together. The Israeli Defense Force, it realizes it's in a fight for its life. As soon as it's legal, it's bringing shiploads of those people from Cyprus. These are Holocaust survivors. They've been brutalized in all kinds of terrible cases. They're walking off the ship and almost instantly being given a gun loaded on a truck and say, go fight over here. We've got desperate needs. Israeli agents are scouring Europe for World War II surplus weapons like planes and cannons and rifles, ammunition. So right at first, it feels pretty terrible. They're fighting rearguard actions, barely able to keep at bay the armies attacking them. But very quickly, this force grows, and it's super motivated. These are people who say, never again will we go through something like that. It's super motivated, and it starts to get its supplies problems figured out, and Israel wins that war. So this is what the UN said they would get. But this is actually what they got. By the end of that fighting in 1949, Israel has managed to capture all of this area and this area, and it's even slightly shrunk some of the West Bank area. So this is what comes out of the war. This is the modern state of Israel. And the modern state of Israel would go on to win quite a few wars with the Arabs. Part of the reason it does is because it is very fully supported and funded by the United States. The Six-Day War in 1967 sees Israel take all of the West Bank, and now Israel controls the West Bank. So the modern nation of Israel has this large West Bank area inside of it. It controls it, but that area is mostly Palestinian, with kind of growing sections of Jewish colonization. The Gaza Strip has also had historically been Palestinian. Now with this current war, I think Israel is pretty much in control of all the surface. I don't know about the tunnels underneath it yet. So in other words, the state of Israel has gotten all of Palestine. It's controlling it all, even though initially it was given about half of it or so. The Yom Kippur War is another. There are several invasions of Lebanon. Quite a few conflicts between Israel and the Palestinians. Now, like I said, it's been able to do this In large part because it's been very thoroughly supported by the U.S. The U.S. has been its primary ally, and the U.S. has blocked quite a few U.N. Security Council resolutions that have condemned Israeli actions. So in many, many ways at the national level, the United States is the main reason that Israel has not been kind of disciplined by the international community. So, from the vantage point of the Muslims, it looks like the Christians are winning again, right? Another thing that should be noted here, very consistently throughout the 20th century and at least until very recently, and I think until currently, the most supportive voting bloc in the United States for Israeli pro-Israeli policies has been the conservative evangelical Christian vote. That vote has been the one that has largely carried, or that has often been relied on to drive pro-Israeli policies. So from the vantage point of the Muslim world, there's not much that has changed in the struggle between Christians and Muslims, except that right now, the Christian world is militarily more powerful than they are. This belief seriously damages the growth of the kingdom of Christ among these Muslim countries. And our next session, we're going to look at what we should do about this state of affairs. Are there questions about this, about what I've talked about here? So I've tried to avoid controversy, but I still might have stumbled into some. Go ahead, Jalen. Good point. So you've got the Jordan River here. And so it's on the western side of the Jordan River.
Yeah. Hey, how is it related to Jordan?
I mean, how is the West Bank related to Jordan?
Would Jordan consider the West Bank part of them yet, or they did for a while?
Okay, so you're starting to get into the weeds. Okay, so it involves the British. The British promised two different Arab rulers parts of the Middle East in the World War I. So you had Lawrence of Arabia roaming around down there, and he had made promises, and then the British diplomats made different promises. So they ended up with two different kings who wanted chunks, and that's why why Jordan, it was initially called the Transjordan, as an across the Jordan, why the Transjordan was given to the current reigning monarch of Jordan. And then the Saudis got... the Saud family got Saudi Arabia. So that was kind of the split there. As far as why they want the West Bank, I can't remember for sure. You're getting to the edge of my knowledge here, but I kind of think they may have been promised some of that, but I'm not sure by any official channels or not. Do you know more about this than I do?
No, I just knew it was kind of related to it. Mm-hmm. I wasn't quite sure why. I mean, I thought Jordan had a little bit of interest in it.
It did, yeah. I'm sorry. I don't think I should speak authoritatively on that. I don't think I know that. Yeah. Okay, any other questions? Yes. Yes. Jerusalem. Oh, I'm not sure if the other map was better or not. Okay, here's Jerusalem. So on this map, Jerusalem is right here, I think. Does that make sense? Any other questions? Okay. Thank you for your attention. I will hand it over to Merle.
With the opportunity to spend some time just together as a body like this, and he taught, we just pray for Darrell as he brings us a second session. Just pray that you would just help him to share the burden that you've laid on his heart and give us the ears to hear and receive it. We pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.
Thank you. So I'm thinking of a kid's game, Whack-A-Mole. Have you heard of Whack-A-Mole? That's this game. And I'm thinking of the analog version, not any digital version. Basically, you take a hammer and you hit a mole that sticks its head up. Hit it. It drops its head down, and instantly a mole pops up over here, and then you hit it there, and then you hit it here, and the mole just keeps popping up. You hit it one spot, it pops up at another spot. How do you win that game? It seems completely unwinnable. I mean, maybe if you hit faster, Well, I think there's a way to win it. I think you need to use a bigger hammer so that mole stays down when you hit it. So I think we've done a lot of foolish thinking around fighting evil in the Christian history that we've been reading or listening to. There have been a lot of empires trying to stamp out this evil by hitting it with this tiny little hammer. And the hammer that they're using is coercion, violence. It's forcing, physically forcing people to obey the Bible, is what they're thinking. Or at least support their political agenda. And I think this little wimpy hammer of coercion or violence, I think it needs to be thrown away. And I think the church needs to stop using that. And I think it needs to use the hammer God gave us. Jesus came, and he taught us how to fight evil. It's very clear that when Jesus says, if your enemy thirsts, give him drink. If he hungers, feed him. For in so doing, you'll heap coals of fire on his head. That he's giving us a way to attack evil. Now, he showed us, too, how to fight evil. He came as a man. This is divine God, came as a man, and he died. He loved so deeply that he sacrificed his life. This is the life that started the world. He sacrificed it in order to overcome the evil that we had brought into the world. And then he said, now you go redeem the world in tiny little ways like I have redeemed you. You're still using that power. It's the power of sacrificially loving. Loving so deeply that it hurts. You sacrifice something of great import. That's what the big hammer does. If you use that hammer, the evil doesn't just move around and pop up in some other form, like the mole. No, the evil, when you hit it with this hammer, it's all gone. It goes away. It destroys evil. It often is very painful to fight evil that way. It often costs us a lot. But then the evil is gone. So the most you can hope for with any form of coercive attack on evil is you're going to move it around. So think about the Crusades. The Christians thought, we've got this evil going on. Let's take care of it. They brought the best they had. They did the worst they could. It sure didn't last very long. It didn't fix anything. It created a bigger problem. If anything, more evil came out of that. So I think the church has simply, since the time of Constantine, has simply not been able to see its blind spot regarding the tiny little hammer that Constantine gave them to fight with. They should have thrown that thing away and continued to use the hammer that they had been using, because people like Tertullian had long noticed that the blood of the martyrs, that's the seed of the church. And you can't eradicate an organization that loves sacrificially. It doesn't go away. And the evil it disappears around it. It's kind of an evil eater. It gets rid of it. So let's notice some of the cycles that we, you guys have stuck with me very well through these five sessions. I know I've been throwing a lot of information at you. Some of it has probably been a little bit obscure. But let's just kind of think back through the cycles we've seen already in at least the level of history that we've been looking at, which is admittedly maybe 30,000-foot view of history. But notice the cycles we've seen. First, Constantine offers political and legal power to Christians. That's this. Next, Christians use this power to control what Christians believe. That's, think Arius being exiled, pushed. Boom, he pops up outside of the empire, starts a movement amongst the Germanic tribes. Next, they use this, their military power, to try to change what non-Christians believe. So that's their wars with the Persian Empire. They're out there trying to fix the Zoroastrians' bad beliefs. Then non-Christians, the Muslim Arabs, come along. They're also using a little hammer, and they're attacking the Christians. They're oppressing the Christian Byzantine Empire. Soon, the Christians from the West in the Crusades are using their military power against the Muslims to try to gain control of Jerusalem. Still hitting it, the evil with this hammer. Then it's the turn of the Turks, the Muslim Turks, to try to conquer or to conquer the Christian city of Constantinople. Now they're being assaulted. You see how cyclical this is? It's just over and over the same thing. Finally, once again, it's the Christian majority French and British empires in the wake of the world wars that impose their will on the Muslims of the Middle East and establish the national boundaries of most of the modern nations in that region. And I think most significantly, it's the evangelical Christians who are most enthusiastic supporters of the establishment of the state of Israel. They're trying to stamp out evil. They're trying to eradicate evil with this little hammer. The most enthusiastic supporters of the establishment of the state of Israel and who continue to funnel both money and political support to Israel. Those are the cycles we've seen over and over and over. Always trying to stamp out evil with a tiny little hammer. These cycles are just going to keep going. They're not going to end. So what do we need to do about it? That's the goal of this session. What I want to do is learn. So we don't want to go back in those cycles. What do we do? How do we fix it? What can we do? The people here in this room, is there anything? So I'm going to suggest there are kind of two parts to answer this question. I would say the first part is we've got to recognize the modern incarnation of these coercive cycles. So let's just look around and see, how are these cycles continuing? What are the things that we know of right now that are part of these cycles? And then after we're done answering that, we'll start talking about the second part of how to fix this problem. So I'll throw out some here. There'll be room for a lot of discussion in this, so be listening. You can add in your own observations or ask questions. I don't care. So number one, one modern incarnation. Do you understand the word incarnation? We're talking about one modern iteration, I guess, of this cycle, is political Christianity. I think Christianity has always been involved in politics in the United States, but I think the current, I don't know, things are maybe changing right as we watch, but at least a historian's view is kind of 25 years and back. So if we just stop at 25 years, that makes me feel like I know a little bit more. When you get into the current events, it can get a little confusing what's going on. But I think for much of Christian history, the Ronald Reagan era of offering the church power in exchange for support, where basically the Republican Party offered the fundamental Christian groups in the United States that they would push for their policy agendas if they are supported by voting. I think that's kind of like Constantine offering the church political power too. So I really think the Ronald Reagan era is kind of a watershed. It's where the church starts moving towards political power. So I think political Christianity is part of the story, one of the modern iterations of this cycle. I think in the last 15 or 20 years, Christian nationalism has just become a much louder, much more unpleasant sound to it. This often shows up in debates around immigration because Christian nationalists kind of want to keep everybody out who's not Christian. I don't know how much, I'm not really interested in getting super political here since I think politics is kind of a little bit pointless. We're not going to fix anything with it. But just do note it's going on. So this often surrounds the immigration debate. So if you want to talk about Christian nationalism, often immigration is involved. You can kind of, I'm not going to say much more about that, but if you want to bring out more, that's fine. Just note that political power is what they're using to try to keep the nation Christian, if you wish. Since another iteration of this, so in addition to political Christianity and the rise of Christian nationalism, the American evangelicalism has been supporting Zionism very, very strongly. So you'll find this in a bunch of different places. Often books, even books we really agree with, will come out with a very strong tone that Israel is the rightful owner of the land of Palestine. even if they eschew other aspects of political Christianity or even outright Christian nationalism, often these people will think that it is okay for Israel to do whatever it needs to live in the land it's in. And really, that's just a manifestation of trying to fix evil with some sort of coercive power. So for me, this isn't a particularly Christian view. It is a non-Christian view. I'm not even going to say whether it's good or bad. I'm just saying it's not effective at fixing anything. This is not going to fix it. So what other iterations of these cycles would you point out? So I've talked about Christian nationalism. I've talked about political Christianity. I've talked about Christian Zionism. What other things would you like to throw in here that are just modern manifestations of trying to fix evil, especially in our relationships with Muslims, using coercion of some sort? Do you have any to add to the list? Yes. Ah. Especially in Central America, is that correct? Yeah. And yeah. 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 That's a really helpful observation. Clearly, this is a man who has interacted with the world on a broader scale than I have, but he's exactly right. Liberation technology, theology is, I don't know exactly where it comes from, but I know it is present in Catholic circles pretty strongly, and especially there was a lot going on in Central America. And it was basically the idea that it is wrong to oppress people, which sounds biblical, but the way they wanted to fix it was primarily political. Good observation. Any others to add? Okay, that's good. So we've named some modern iterations. So I think the last piece we want to do here now. So if remember, what we're trying to do is we're trying to think, how can we fix? How can we get away from this hammer and move to the painful hammer of sacrificial love to fight evil? So if we know what some of the things are that are going on now that tend towards coercion and violence and don't really fix the problem, the next question is, well, the next statement I'd like to make is a better way of saying it. The next thing to do then is to reject those, to say, no, we're not going to go that direction. We're not interested in fixing those problems politically. What can I do? What can I sacrifice right now? In what way can I begin to wield the power that the church has been given? So we need to reject the impulse to play the game and look to destroy the evil. Now, quite frankly, this is where we need our most creative thinkers. And I think this is where we as groups need to work together and to be most creative. How do we go about deploying sacrificial love? It's certainly not something we can do at a national level. It might not always even be things we can do at a church-wide level. Sometimes this is individual decisions. But there are things. There are ways we can deploy sacrificially loving our neighbor or loving anybody in a way that will help start destroying the evil. And do note that we are talking about things that are evil. It is evil to think that Jesus is not God. He is God, and to think otherwise is blasphemy. But remember, Jesus said, the people we name as enemies, those are the people we treat like enemies. And the way he said to treat enemies is to pray for them, to do good to them, to love them. That's what we're talking about. So here are a couple of suggestions. I'll throw them out. This is only a start. It's not going to deal with nearly all of the evil present, but it might help you as we work together, because I'd like to hear you brainstorming with me, maybe giving me examples soon here. So instead of trying to outlaw abortion, How about offering to adopt a child as soon as it's born as an alternative to abortion? That's a painful sacrifice. It's a joyful sacrifice, but it's also a serious commitment. That costs something, and it's a way to fight the evil. Wouldn't that be a better way than trying to get the right Supreme Court in there to make it illegal? What if we just went and cared for the people who are having the children who need to be adopted? I don't know if it's better, but it sure would be more effective. instead of passing new laws for enforcing drug control, maybe start volunteering at a Big Brothers, Big Sisters mentoring program to help children at risk of gang involvement. Instead of policing immigration laws, maybe we can join a support team for a legal immigrant. My wife and I did that recently in Hutchinson. There was a group of 10 families that were legally resettled there, and we had the chance to join a team of people around this Syrian family and help initiate them into American society. We didn't convert them, but we showed them Christ's love. We didn't tell them they were evil, but we showed them we cared about them. So, what are some other things that you would like to put on this list? What are other ways? Yes?
At the basic level, this is, I think, where a lot of the problem is, the pastors develop an attitude that humans are all evil. And that a lot of the Americans, not only are they very great, the Americans only put people at a higher level and good people. It's justifiable to do what you do to the people because they're less than Americans.
Yeah.
Less than human,
yeah.
So you can justify all kinds of evil.
Yeah.
The other people there.
Yep. And words like illegal get thrown around because it helps make them not as human, but more somebody deserving of punishment.
Well, and what happens, what helps that is you criminalize that.
Yes.
Which is really just not a criminal act, like, you know, a violent act.
Yeah. Yes. Very good point. So Alfredo is suggesting a very important mental shift that is part of this is starting to see people as people. Whether they're attacking you or whether they're being kind to you, they're always people. And you treat them the way Jesus taught you to. Good. What else? Note that this is not always obvious. There isn't always an obvious way forward, but I think we can find ways.
I think maybe this is a little bit more of a conceptual idea rather than a boots
sure,
on the ground.
Sure, that's fine.
But looking to serve what I would call the more unseen people in our community.
Are you specifically thinking about people without power? Or are you just talking about people who are a little less obvious to us?
They are the people that have fallen through the cracks of society, mm-hmm. one way or the other. Whether they're here, they're part of the subculture that's not the majority of the culture, or if they are the homeless population that we encounter. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And in various ways.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's significant that that's the people that Jesus ministered to.
Yeah.
In his time on this earth. He was comfortable in palaces, but that's where he ministered was to the people that were on the margins of society.
Yes.
So that could be your prison population. It could be even people that are that have a person that's incarcerated.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I think our government and their use of their powers directed at evil, God says it's okay. That's their place.
They're fighting evil.
Yes.
I mean, it's ineffective, but they're still fighting it, right?
Right.
Great.
But we as believers are called to fight evil with good.
Mm-hmm.
That's what
we're called to destroy evil.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And when you think about that, that calls you to touch people's lives.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, think of redemption rather than punishment. Mm-hmm. Good. Yes.
Okay, so, yeah, in this discussion, there has to be something different about, you mentioned a shift in thought.
Yeah.
The way we think
mm-hmm.
directs our actions
mm-hmm.
today.
Yeah.
Is there some fundamental difference in the thinking between nominal Christian, so-called, and
yeah.
Mm-hmm. Specifically, we all ascribe to the scripture.
Right.
The book.
Yep.
That's our authority.
Mm-hmm.
God says of himself, I change not. Now, how do we explain to a Christian who is into this national belief
mm-hmm.
that says, look, and I just read it this morning in my private reading, the Lord told Moses that when you cross over the Jordan, you are to dispossess that land of the people that are there.
Yes.
And drive them out. Because, yeah, and if you don't do that and keep them under control, they will possess you.
Yeah.
And you will get the brunt of my,
mm-hmm.
my action. How do we explain that
yeah.
to them?
Yeah.
How do we live, yeah.
Fantastic question. The question is, does Israel have a right to the land it's occupying? And if so, does that right then mean that it can do anything it needs to keep the land? I mean, they're kind of two different questions. Okay. This might be a place where you guys get to help here. I think my short answer, and it's okay if you shape it for me. I think my short answer is, we do need to think about what the promise, we need to think about the Old Covenant, what the Old Covenant is, and what it has promised. So it was a promise to a people, to a people group, that they, if they were God's people, then God would reward them. And they had a function. Through all, God said to Abraham, through you all the nations of the world will be blessed. And we understand that to be a prophecy of Jesus coming. So Jesus came, he blessed all of the nations of the world by bringing redemption. Well, in the New Testament, we have quite a few places where people like Paul are saying, the old covenant has passed away, a new covenant has replaced it. And I think our argument with people who hold very firmly that Israel ought to have that land and it can do anything it wants to, I think our argument boils, or my argument with them boils down to whether we see that promise as unending throughout time. They always have that. Or whether that covenant has passed and there's a new covenant, and that doesn't require God to have changed, because God's plan is developing over time. We see how he gave Israel a command, and then he brought Jesus, and Jesus came and said, but I say unto you. So we understand God to have changed his ethical requirements for people, even though God hasn't changed. He said, you're at a different place now. You can do other things. I've given you more power. I've given you this. So we have changed, not God. Israel's promised land fulfilled its objectives of giving them a place where they could maintain the worship of Yahweh. And that covenant, as I understand it, has passed away, and a new covenant has replaced it, in which they and everybody else are welcomed into the throne room of God. So that, in my opinion, that covenant, that promise, is not of significance to the current. But there will probably be disagreements here in this room about that, I'm guessing. Go ahead, Alfredo.
Before the long-term Jewish nation was already a nation to Abraham.
Mm-hmm.
Which says that we all have left all families of the earth. And now that the temple, the Old Testament temple, now we as people of God are sacred space for God
yeah.
dwells.
Yeah.
So the same principles are still there.
Yeah.
But it's a spiritual kingdom, the kingdom of God.
Yeah. I wonder if we shouldn't sit on this a little bit. Do you have more to say, Kevin? Okay. Are there some other... go ahead.
Some things that are extremely difficult to sort through for me.
Yeah.
My best is that what you have presented is the foundation.
Uh-huh.
But there's something that I don't know how to sort through. The Revolutionary War. The chaos in believers' response to it.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
The authority of structure was
yeah.
changed.
Yeah.
So how do we feel about that?
Yeah.
This idea, does Israel have a right to the land? Does the United States have a right to this? So I think what I'm...
Wait, this is Texas. Yeah.
There is some level of mystery in what
yeah.
God is
yeah.
doing in kingdoms. In my personal judgment, I'll go on record here. I would support that Israel has a right to the land, not on the basis of the Abrahamic covenant, but on how God has put nations together. For
ah, uh-huh. Interesting.
They have as right, let's just
leave. Sure. I'm quite comfortable with some, yeah.
For a, this part of the
sure.
mm-hmm. on the foundation that we're not called to be a part of that.
Yeah.
We're not even, yeah. we don't even want to. My challenge has been to not emotionally get attached.
Yeah.
I lose
yeah.
my bearings.
Yeah.
But let's not forget that God is sovereignly arranging nations.
Yes.
And I think we should ask ourselves these questions. Are they relevant to someone in North Vietnam right now?
Interesting,
Are
yeah.
Are they relevant to someone in South Africa?
Yeah.
Are they relevant to Australia? God doesn't change.
Right.
I think the answers that we're grappling to come up with should be applicable to everyone.
Yes.
Not
yes.
in the kind of government,
yes.
but in God's rule over the nation.
Yes.
And I'd appeal for us to speak very, very respectfully on that.
Yes. Yeah, you're bringing something very helpful up here. Note, when we're saying these things, we're noting, especially when I was talking about how Palestine was formed, what we're noting here, I'm not tracking legitimacy or not. What I'm tracking is effect.
Yes, yes.
Okay? So what I get nervous, like Elmer does, I get nervous when we start talking about right and wrong and what the right way to do it is and who's right and who's wrong. That's, we belong to the kingdom of God, and we've got what we need to fight. So very helpful. Whatever we say here needs to be held with some humility, or a lot of humility, because we are talking about things that have been difficult for Christians over the centuries. Yeah, any more? Go ahead, Jalen. Okay.
And that is to look at some of the political operations and things. And I will highlight one, and that is the very liberal abortion policy that
mm-hmm.
people has. And I'm not sure if you're aware of it or not.
I don't think I would know that. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I mean, just for starters, an Israeli lady in the defense force.
Feels like a conflict of interest.
It feels very comfortable to sit for
help. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's good. Okay, go ahead. Okay.
For one, who is the king of Israel? Jesus, right? The president, Jesus is the king of Israel. Like, that's, again, the likes of their king.
Sure.
Think three parts.
Okay.
So, you have the king of Israel, and then you have the nation of Israel, and then you have the people of Israel.
Okay.
And God fulfilled his covenant with Abraham, with the kingdom of Israel.
Uh-huh. I see what you're saying.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I see what you're saying.
And then there are the Jews, which are the people of Israel, which are, you know, descendants from Abraham.
Yeah.
And I feel like we need to keep those separate. And that if we keep those separate, we'll have a lot better way of reading the Bible.
Yes.
And we won't get so politically
involved. Yeah, yeah. That's a very good point. When you see Israel in the Bible, try not to read the state of Israel, because that's not really what's in view. Good. Dad.
Mm-hmm. And some of what you're talking about here is the state has one responsibility of protecting its people and operating under that.
Mm-hmm.
The Christian, the church, has a responsibility to love their neighbor.
Yes.
And we,
yeah.
When we become politically involved, we
right.
try to marry the two.
Yeah. You're pointing to something I should have maybe said a little bit differently, or a little bit more completely. I am not quite saying that this is an immoral force, because I do believe the state is fighting evil, which is a legitimate thing for it to do. So I'm not quite saying to use this is always wrong. I will say it's always ineffective. So that's kind of the language I tend to use. To say it another way gets you into some strange conundrums that are kind of hard to fix. And I don't know if we need to go into that. Go ahead, Dad,
well,
and then
what
Alfredo.
I was going to say was, I agree with you 100%, but it's wrong for the church to use that hand.
I do believe that. I believe that if the church is using coercion, it has abdicated its position as the hands and feet of Jesus.
We
might have to, well, we'll see how this develops. Go ahead, Alfredo.
Well, I say that the problem that happens is, whether it's political or personal level, is you can use evil to fight a greater evil.
Ah.
Says we become,
like the evil. Yeah, that's good. Okay, we could probably go on for a while, but I think we're having a fellowship dinner afterwards, so we can just move that discussion over there, and there'll be food involved, and I think that's probably a better one. So I think this is a good place to bring this to a close. So did you want me to pray and then hand it off to you, or do you want to just come up and take over? Okay, let's pray. Father,